you didn't know, this is called creative church planning. And what this means is that we have three very great church planners here who have very different experiences. And the reason I know they're going to do well with this is because what they're doing, they're just telling you their story. But there's something in each story that I hope God speaks to you deeply on. And so we're gonna squeeze as much as we can, probably in like the next 20 minutes, and then have Q&A. Okay, so by the way, my name's Sean Robinson. I'm on the National Church Planning Team. I'm from California. This is my partner in crime, Shane Sun. And Shane is church planner, church assessment leader, godly man extraordinaire from Colorado and other regions. That's good enough. Let's start there. Hey, so one of the things I do want to let you know is we're going to pass around this highly technical pad of paper that says name, email, comments in like scribble. And what I'd love for you to do, put your name and email, obviously. And then comments are, I want a church plant. I want to know more. Contact me. Don't bug me. Whatever you want. But we just want to just kind of have a record of who is here. If you don't want any contact, write that down. We will honor that. But this is where we want to start. And we start with you, Jamie. This is where we want to start. Is what we want to do is just have these three gentlemen introduce themselves and just how they were led to start this church that they started and just a little bit about their church. And they're going to do it in 3 minutes or less. So this is the trick, okay? So you ready to be first?
Should we shut the door?
Yeah,
I hope we're not.
They may want to hear what we have to say.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I see what you're saying.
No, you can shut. That's fine. That's fine. Okay, you ready, Rick?
So, give me the question again.
Your name? Okay, so you were led to plant this church, and just a little bit about your journey, what God, how God led you to think outside the box, and a little bit about what you're about in 3 minutes or less. How's that?
My name is Rick Schaefer. I'm a church planter in Phoenix, Arizona. I had been, I'm with EPC now for going on 2 years. I've been with the PCA about 20 years, been a church planter in Southern California. Was led to plant the EPC. I also work with YWAM. I was probably the only PCA ordained guy in the regular rotation of YWAM. I was a rare bird over there. But doing that, my wife and I really developed a passion for the hedges and the highways and the least of these and refugees. And through the stirring and leading of the Lord, not only did we go to Phoenix, but we wanted to go to those hedges and highways. And for us, that meant like doing a house church as a part of that. So we have now a house church network in Phoenix, and we've been there 3 years. So that's us in a nutshell.
My name is Boone. I am currently in our church plant, The Bridge, North County, is currently in Ferguson, where my family and I have lived since 2004. I have been actively involved in church planting since 2007, now planting, lead pastor planting of my second church in Ferguson. This church plant is uniquely different than the first one. The first one I did was a homogenous African-American church in an underserved, kind of border of underserved and working class community. This particular plant was intentionally a multi-ethnic church plant in Ferguson, where we planted with two full-time pastors, myself and an Anglo guy by the name of Nathan. And this time we really felt led and called to plant a multi-ethnic church because I really believe for our location, our social location, everybody's location is different, but for our social location right there in Ferguson, for many of you know, that was ground zero several years back when the killing of Mike Brown, when the country kind of erupted, and that set on a series of just tragic events. And so we felt like it was very necessary for us to plant a multi-ethnic church to be a foretaste of how we know the story is going to end with every tribe, every tongue, and every nation worshiping together at the feet of the Lamb. So we believe that this multi-ethnic church is an expression in our local location as one of the best apologetics for the gospel.
I'm just going to give the mic back to you, have you preach, man. Come on, Boone. My name is Aaron Gibson, part of the Lake Forest family of churches planted in the northern region of Charlotte 9 years ago. My town's actually called Denver. We call it Denver of the East, or sometimes we call y'all out here Denver of the West, if anybody's actually a Denver person. Was in Los Angeles for 25 years prior to that. I was a number two at a very large, functionally non-denominational church. Burned out, ready to quit ministry. Was looking for some way to do ministry without having to work for the church. You ever felt that way? So I stayed up all night doing what... Yeah, it's all good. I see that hand, brother. I see that hand. I did one night, I was 37 years old, I did one night what Eugene Peterson calls ecclesiological pornography, which is where you look at other churches as if they make better lovers. And you ever heard that phrase? Isn't that Eugene, man? Yeah, I'll tell you what. And finding none, I decided I was going to go back. My undergrad was in psychology from UCLA. I was going to go pursue therapy for myself, too, but also as a career. But in that process, I came across, on Gordon Conwell's website, I came across an ad for Lake Forest, which is a church for folks who've given up on church but not on God. And I thought, man, I could tattoo that on my arm. So I threw my name in the hat, jumped in. We launched on Super Bowl Sunday 2013. 2014. Super Bowl Sunday 2014. And some people were like, are you sure you want to launch on Super Bowl Sunday? I said, our team's the Panthers. There's no risk. I mean, we're never going to. I'm a Panthers fan, baby. Don't get me wrong. But so it's been a 9-year journey. We moved into our, we were in a school, then a Y, kicked out during COVID. You guys all know those stories. We moved into our permanent facility, ground up build that we did just about 18 months ago. Really amazing journey in terms of just how God has done that. We're in a sub-rural area. That's a traditionally rural area north of Charlotte on Lake Norman, western side, that is just exploding with homes. So we're your classic, this, you know, just rooftops everywhere. And so not enough churches in the region. What do you do? That's kind of our call.
While you have the mic, we're just going to start now going back.
Okay.
So here's the next part of this, part B, is, okay, tell some of the influencers, some of the factors that kind of guided your decision-making along the way, and just maybe some of those initially, something that just guided and led you that, okay?
To plant the way you did.
Right. Influencers and
yeah.
Factors, right?
Yeah, okay, great. Well, I mean, I had the privilege of having both as a colleague and a coach, this guy right here. Some of y'all know Mike. So I had the privilege of having Mike as my coach when I was planting. And I'd been a part of the Gen X church planting movement in the 90s. Most of y'all probably weren't born yet. But the 90s, that's when we kind of gave the finger to the church and said, y'all don't know how to do it. We're going
to
do it right.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Great start.
Thanks. Yeah, I just, you know, trying to keep it. Yeah, trying to keep it real. Trying to keep it real. Okay. So, you know, we did the Gen X thing, and it was awesome. I mean, we were on the rooftop of the old Pabst Brewery on I-5 downtown LA, right across from Dodger Stadium. We baptized people in converted fermentation tanks they made into swimming pools. It was awesome. We had no idea how to run a church. And without accountability, without structure, without relationship, without those who'd gone before us helping us, we just crashed and burned. So it was 3 years of my life. I mean, my heart, soul. And so the fact that that was the experience, crashed and burned, and I gave up on church, I almost gave up on God. So to go back into church planting, I was, when the Lord was calling me at 37 to do that again, I mean, I wanted nothing more than that, but I was also scared to death because I'd been burned. I was like, I don't want to lose my faith over this. You know, it's one thing to just leave ministry. I didn't want to lose my faith. And so I'd say the most influential thing was connecting with the Lake Forest family, with Mike, with Michael Flake. Some of y'all know Michael Flake, teaching elder at Story Hill Church. Others who had done it, that was the greatest influence.
So just to kind of capsule straight, we talked about accountability, relationships, coaching. Just so you know, if you're Presbytery, if you don't have church plant liaison or whatever they're called in Presbytery, we have access to coaches. And if you're a church, you don't want to just say, oh, we found someone, good luck, goodbye. Okay, and that's really key. And so we have some resources, some people in every Presbytery, so don't think that's just something you have to figure out on your own. That's what we work together for. Okay,
yeah.
On the move.
Yeah, I think the main factor for me was just the cultural moment that we found ourselves in during the time we were about to plant our church. It was becoming increasingly more and more difficult for me, as I had been engaged in what we call cultural apologetics for over 20 years, as I owned and operated a barbershop in a homogenous community, in an African-American community. And more, after 2016 election, after Mike Brown, after the 2020 election, after George Floyd, more and more people in my context, in my community, began to lose confidence, faith in the church. The church had lost its credibility, its prophetic voice. And so the thing I began to get more than I had ever gotten in my life or my ministerial career was, is Christianity even a religion for black people? And so when I began to engage in that and experience with that, as my heart began to break, I felt like it was something that I needed to do to help reach the community, to help bring some healing to the hurt and to the pain that was all around us. And I was like, if the gospel can't address adequately the problem that we're facing and that we're dealing with today, nothing really can, or nothing will. And so it just had to work for me. The gospel had to be enough. It just had to be. And so I was willing at that time to just stake it all. I had already planted a church from 2007 to 2017, a 10-year run with a white evangelical denomination that closed down, that ended very, very difficult. It was extremely hard. And so I, you know, like you, I didn't know if I was ever going to pastor again. I was broken. I had lost all confidence. I had wondered if I had failed my family, everything you can imagine. I remember I was just sharing this last night, when that church plant closed 10 years, we were buying this building, and we had to turn the building back over. We were buying the building through one of the local associations with the denomination I won't name. And I showed up on a Wednesday, like my last meeting, at the church plant with the keys. And the advice I was given was, hand the keys over to this guy. He's going to be the next church planter in this church. And I didn't hear from anybody else. Right. Oh. Right. And so it was extremely painful. But I was still convinced and compelled by the gospel. I was still convinced and compelled by what Christ had done in my life. And I was still convinced and compelled that the gospel still could address the issues. And so we went out and planted again.
Wow. So here's one thing we want you to remember. Luke could have walked away from it all, right? And in this denomination, he believed that there's a place for people of all colors, right? And so this is important because for some of you, we're, as a denomination, pretty good at planning suburban white churches,
yep.
Right? But one of our key things, underserved, under-resourced areas, and we want churches that look like our neighborhoods, not just like us. Mm. And so Boone took a big risk. And my, or our career, this church planting team, is that when we have seminars and years come from this, we have more people who look like Boone and look like people like me, okay? And so for those of you who say, okay, this is what our church makeup is, maybe God's stretching you to go beyond that. And I will tell you, you cannot come in as experts. You have to come in as learners. And Boone is a key person for this, okay? So just kind of, not to put you in the spot. Boone's in charge of it all. Okay, no. That's not what we're saying. But we have to come learning and open. So that's really key.
So 15 years ago, roughly, I was pastoring this also a homogenous church in Long Beach, California, but it was filled with hipsters. We were 100% hipster, one side to the other, a couple hundred of them.
This is just like Boone's church.
Exactly. Also multi-ethnic, but the dominant note was hipster. And in many respects, we were doing well. We had a couple hundred people, and you know, it's like everybody who was in a band in our city was in our church, and everybody who kicked out of Biola and Azusa and all these other places, they were in our church. But I would come home every Sunday, and I would call a friend of mine, and I can remember standing on the driveway and telling this buddy of mine, something's desperately broken about what we're doing. Like, there's the fingerprint of God is missing from my ministry. Like, I am uncompelled by what they seem to be a little bit stirred by. Like, this can't be it. And that was the beginning of God kind of breaking me down and really bringing me to the end of myself and a spiritual awakening in my life. That looked very similar kind of to the Jack Miller story. I resigned, I went away, and Isaiah became my friend. And through Isaiah, God just began to speak to me. And so if you ask, like, what is the main influence? Well, God used Isaiah in my life. And I had no, I felt like I had no biblical expectancy. I remember telling God, I've done 6 years of graduate school, and I don't know anything about your kingdom. Like, I'm tired of drawing up strategic plans. I don't want to be a rosy-eyed optimist. I want to know what you dipped your finger in and promised to do in the blood of your son. What did you promise to do in the coming of the kingdom? And what can I expect as I go forward? Well, that just began a journey for my wife and I that changed us over a period of like 2 or 3 years. And it sent us all, I'm on a crazy journey for about 5 years. Out of that, and that's where I got introduced to YWAM, and I just saw things that were out of sync with my experience in knowing the Lord. And it was the reality of the kingdom. And one of the verses that God gave me during that time was Isaiah 41:20. And it talks about in this arrival of the kingdom, that it would come with such a measure, with such magnitude, with such focus, that the nations would see and consider together that the hand of the Lord has done this. And I remember looking at my wife and saying, I don't want my personality type, I don't want my character, I don't want my size, I don't want my voice to be a sufficient enough explanation for the ministry that we have in front of us. I don't want to have five loaves and two fish and feed 7 people. Like, you can explain that. I said, but I also don't want to have 5 loaves and 2 fish and feed 500 and leave grace on the table. I want to go where God has prepared to go. And part of that was going now to the hedges and the highways. And like Boone was saying, we would stand there and look at our window and say, Katie, we have to believe that these people are, it's not too evil, too far gone, too dead, beyond the reach of the gospel. Like, we're going to go to that place and we're going to begin the work of believing. Like, we've done ministry model, we've done strategic plan, we've done all that. But you know what we haven't done? John 6, the work of believing. And so we would just start. We started interceding in a way we had never done before. We had done prayer, but we didn't know what intercession was. And we didn't know what the intercession of faith was, to grab hold of the promises of God and to say, God, you have promised to do this for the sake of the glory of your son, that all the nations would know who Jesus is. And so we just started claiming this stuff and praying over our neighborhood, right? And that began a journey, and that kind of leads to a flyer over there that's on. I got a bunch of them. We have started something called Finkenwald US, and it's based off what Dietrich Bonhoeffer did in Germany during World War II. And it's really become our passion for Gen Z and the emerging generation to equip spiritual leaders in the way that I wasn't equipped. I went to seminary, I was taught ministry model, but there wasn't a person whose life I could look at who would say to me, hey, the thing that you've seen in me and heard in me, as you've seen me walk out the life of faith, as you've seen me live out the gospel, as you've seen me intercede, as you've seen me do those things, go and do likewise. So we've got a bunch of pastors who are opening their homes in Phoenix. Actually, I met with someone yesterday. We're going to do this in Denver, too. And they were... We're going to have these Gen Zers come live with us for 9 months and then send out a new wave of, hopefully, spiritual leaders. So anyhow, that's kind of our story.
And just so you know, is that Rick does this bivocational. He's a contractor, too. It's, he doesn't sleep. But so that just gives you an idea of the different backgrounds and stories for each of these men.
And a lot of times cultural settings have to determine models, like, we have a bivocational planter that Rick shepherds and knows in Salt Lake City. And many of the churches we planted there, in my days in the PCA, they folded because we didn't have a sustainable financial model to have enough longevity to continue to win the people that don't know Jesus, you know, and walk with them. So we've got a great guy. So, you know, we're talking about different models, and And even as you move north and west, and where the culture is much more secular, I was a church planter all over in the West, but I'm in downtown Denver now. Your model might need to change, you know, because to reach people, it's just the timeline stretched, and you've got to be, and parish size sometimes needs to get smaller. But we can't avoid looking at it. We can't continue to do, you know, just musical chairs in the church. We've got to figure out how are we, as a denomination, going to go toward, as Rick said, the least of these and reach people that we're not reaching. And we can't do that without a depth of spirituality, which you heard Rick talking about. Yeah, it's got to come from a place of real power that comes from prayer and forsake, you know, and crying out to God that we don't have the strength to do this. And then it also comes, as Sean emphasized, through connecting with other people, because you can't do it alone, and you have to have strength that comes. That's the whole Finkenwalde concept. So I'll shut up, but it just to, and thank you guys. Yeah, come. Hand me the paper. My phone keeps going back. I had it on my phone. I'll read off the sheet of paper if I can read your writing. Okay, we'll do the opposite. We'll go back this way. I'll just hand the mic back to Rick. What did you learn the hard way? Now, we've heard some of that. What has gone surprisingly well? And it's kind of like three questions all in one. And what are some of the advantages and disadvantages of your approach or model? Okay. Does everybody get the question? And feel free, if you need me to repeat a portion of the question, just do so. So what did you learn hard way? What has gone surprisingly well? What are some of the advantages and disadvantages of your approach or model?
What's gone surprisingly well? I think we've been surprised, especially through YWAM, with the impact that we've had on the young generation. Man, we're not savvy. Savvy. You know, so don't ask me about Gen Z and, you know, all the nuances of all of that. I mean, obviously, you know, some, you can't run with YWAM for a long period of time or just be around them and not learn some things. But I think that the major thing that we've not been surprised by, it's been affirmed in us, is this recognition that, like, on the back of my shirt, there's a label, right? Wash, you know, wash and warm. Well, on the back of it, each human being is a label, it's, you know, like baptized in cold water, made to know God, has a soul that thirsts for God. And if you're talking about Gen Z, if you're talking about anything like that, that label still applies. And so if we're walking into YWAM, I can walk into any culture, any room. It's a room of 50 people. I don't know them. How the testimony of the gospel, not just the content of the gospel, but the, you know, I will not speak about anything other than what Christ has done in me. The testimony of the gospel, the aroma, the salt, the aroma of the knowledge of God connects with everybody. So I don't care where I go with YWAM. They don't want to know that I'm a Presbyterian because they just don't even know what to do with that. So I just can't let that stuff out. But as I just share my testimony, what God is doing, I think we've been really affirmed. Like, this, Lord, this is what you said in Isaiah 41. This is what you were going to do. We're seeing that happen. So that's the surprise. What was the other part of that?
I'm just going to testify. I've been there. I was there at his, like, 2 months ago in the conversion stories. And the disciples on the ground that are also praying and entering into this. Yeah, it's amazing. The other question.
The hard way, I think, is part of it.
Yeah, hard way. What surprised you?
Hard lessons of it.
And then.
Real briefly, so then we'll
have what are the advantage or disadvantage of your model?
Yeah, so the disadvantage, going back to Dietrich Bonhoeffer, is, you know, the gospel bids you come and die, right? That's not how I entered ministry. I kind of entered ministry all these years ago, honestly arrogant and pride, like Nebuchadnezzar wanting to build my kingdom. I wouldn't have said that, but deep down, lurking beneath that, I wanted to build my kingdom. I didn't know it. And the hard thing is, like, follow Jesus, choose a fruitful life. He will bid you come and die. I don't care your context, whatever it is. And so there is a perpetual death. It's not been all glamour, you know. We're not saying, hey, this is the glamorous row. You know, it's not been a glamorous story. But God has manifested himself. All I can say is it's cost us everything. You know, we've gone down to zero so many times in our bank account. But like, hey, Mueller did it. We can do it, right? So,
yeah, I think the thing that's just really, in all honesty, it's just going surprisingly well is that our doors are open. Right, we planted a multi-ethnic church in Ferguson, Missouri during a pandemic, during a divisive election year, during one of the, you know, under extreme racial tension. And so what's surprisingly well is every week I show up, right, and others come too. And I think the next question was about our advantages.
Which is hard lessons, surprises, good or bad.
Yeah, so I think everything about church planting provides so many different hard lessons. And I think this one in particular, the hardest lesson I had to learn came at an enormous cost. The hardest lesson I had to learn was my first priority needs to be my wife and my children. Mm-hmm. And so during the midst of this plant, I had a 15-year-old daughter who was dealing with some medical uncertainties. My wife was dealing with some very difficult things. And, you know, we found ourselves in the midst of this and we were broken. And so, so that was very difficult, just learning how to first prioritize my own health and my family over and above the church plant. I'm embarrassed to say, like, this year, I mean, I'm supposed to, like, this is my challenge from my team, is I'm supposed to take a 2-week vacation. I've never taken a 2-week vacation in my life. Last year, I'm embarrassed to say this, my family was the first time we took a 1-week vacation together. Every other vacation I've taken with my family was always around a conference. Right, and so that was what was difficult. We don't know yet, right? We're doing an RV trip. We're doing an RV trip, so we don't know where we're gonna land. My man Aaron has invited me to his crib, so we might end up there.
Our family lives in Budapest, Hungary. If you
want
to come.
I think
a
duck boat, right? Advantages and disadvantages. I think it's going to sound generic, but I'm being as honest and as vulnerable as I possibly can be. Our biggest advantage is there are no models for us to look at. You know, there aren't very many or enough multi-ethnic churches led by African Americans, especially in Reformed Presbyterian spaces. And so there was no models for me to look at, right? And so that is an advantage because that forced me to constantly depend upon the Lord, to trust him with the results, and then constantly have to humble myself every day and say, I do not know what the heck I am doing. I am not talented enough. I am not smart enough. There's not enough resources. Lord, you have to do this by your spirit and just surrender to that. And I think the disadvantage has been the same thing, is that there is not enough models. And so it's been extremely challenging for me to find the right type of mentors. So I've had to have a tribe of mentors to try to meet these needs. I found myself oftentimes in this sense of what I call homelessness, no longer credible or accepted in the African American church because I've cast my lot with y'all. No matter what type of degree I get, I don't know if it's true, but I feel like this, that no matter what I do, I'm never really going to be seen as an equal in this space. You know, time and time again, if I say something hard or new or different, I'm being fact-checked by a white theologian. Amen. Right? And so those are the advantages and the disadvantages, is that there's just not enough models. Yeah, so that was it.
Very good. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, and then we're going to open up for questions, so go ahead.
I'll make it real quick because my model's the one that, if you read any church planting books in the 90s, my model's the one that you're familiar with, right? Lots of rooftops, build a big launch team, have a big kickoff, do it in the school, get a bunch of people doing setup and pack up, and you know the drill. I think what's maybe surprising about that is two things, and then I'll just give it up. The first is that I was surprised to realize that I couldn't do that on my own. The strength of that model is it takes an army of people, right? We can all talk about the downsides of that model, but the strength of that model is you got to get disengaged people to now engage actively in the life of the church to make the church and the mission succeed. And I was thrilled by that. I was surprised to encounter my own limitations. I remember one of the early days showing up, and you know, I'm doing setup left and right. I'm trying to get the pipe and drape up. I'm trying to help get the stage. And Mike says to me, says, you know, dude, you can't do all that. Your job on Sunday mornings is to preach. And I'm like, oh yeah, that's right. You know, and so in the truest sense, it took disengaged people and re-engaged them. I had multiple people who did not know Jesus who were on my launch team, which is awesome. So then my CG guy doesn't know Jesus, and he's operating the lyrics. So here's what's great. My CG guy, more than anybody else in the church, is having to pay attention to the scriptures I'm preaching on that day and the points I'm making, right? So that's just an example of how it engages. I think one of the other things that's been surprising to me in doing this, because I was that rager, Xer, all that stuff, where it's like, man, the church doesn't know what they're doing. We're really... And so I was terrified of being the guy who would just be stealing sheep as I planted. And so one of the great things that I've seen through this more typical model, at least the historically typical model in Northwestern, in the Americas, is that disengaged Christians, or might call them numb Christians, right? Some in other churches have found through their engagement with us a way of reactivating faith or re-engaging mission. And at first I was resistant to that, but then I saw how the Lord was using that, right? The second thing that's surprising and really cool is that it has actually raised the water level for other churches in our community. So one of the best reasons to plant a church in a community is it makes the other churches better. And to see that work has just been a real gift, because it reminds us that the church is bigger than my church plant. It's bigger than that. Dallas Willard said, number one thing a pastor needs to do is pray for the success of the other churches in his or her neighborhoods. And so that's what we've been trying to do.
That's good. It makes the other churches better and paranoid, but other than that. Okay, we're going to questions. We're going to get as many as we can, so it's going to be fast and hard. Okay, I'm going to start. You were first hand up right there, and then I'll come up here and work my way back. Okay.
Cool. Thanks, you guys, for sharing. I remember way back, I think it was like, what was the year Tabidi came to the Church of Planters Retreat? Was that 2018? And you and I were talking, or you were just talking about like plants in general, but like how, especially in an urban situation, you need like a full staff. You know, like you need like to be have a strong team.
And the question is?
Okay, sorry. the question is, I don't know how you guys, just hearing from you talking about re-engaging people as well, but like the paradigm had been, you know, for planters, like you do your rugged individualist thing and get out there and go script together and get these people who are disengaged in terms of mission and get them engaged, or you go find random people, magnetically draw them to the mission of this thing. And you're the buck stops with you. Like you're the guy. And then I look at the biblical model for where Paul goes, and he's got not only Silas or Barnabas, but he's got, you know, John Mark, Luke, whatever. They have a team that's going out. And so my question is just how, and I think, you know, when you had mentioned this with your co-pastor as well, but just in general with you guys, like, how has it been? Do you feel like you're constantly trying to bring the energy level of team members up to where your energy level is? If you were going to plant again, would you wait? What kind of team would you need in order for that to be something that you're like, I'm pumped for this? You talked about burning out. You know, like, is there a way we need to switch gears in terms of the paradigm for church planting where it's not like, here's our planter, we're funding this guy, and he's the guy, and then go, versus we need to, like, form the team.
So I think what we got here is, okay, if starting, did you guys come in with a team? How did that form? That's what I'm hearing, right?
Yep.
Right, okay, and so you got that in your mind? You're kind of, okay, because you're the only one hasn't started a question, so here we go. Okay, I'm going to hold on to the mic because I'm going to keep it roving with you guys real fast.
So, yeah, we absolutely started with a team. We started day one with two full-time pastors. That works. That was necessary for our social location, and I don't think that is fair for me to say that is the right way for every location, every social.
And there's a reason for that in your community.
In our social location, we was intentionally planting a multi-ethnic church, and we wanted to make sure that there was the diversity represented in every area of leadership that we expected to see in our community. And secondly, you know, I'm just being honest, I had a whole lot of experience with pastoring in only homogenous African-American spaces. I needed an Anglo guy to help me translate, to help me learn, and to help me communicate and make the people that looked like him feel at home and feel comfortable and be cared for well also. So that worked for our model. I mean, for our social location.
So you had two pastors, and did you have a core team of any size?
Well, we had a core team and a launch team, but of course we planted during the pandemic, so that meant absolutely nothing.
Okay, how about you?
Yeah, launch team, you know, big, and again, tapping people, giving them clear assignments of leadership. What I would say is I would want to contend that the planter, that someone, if it's not you as the planter, someone on your team has, and I think it's the planter, has to keep the vision hot. Nobody else, somebody's primary assignment is keeping the vision hot. Everybody else has to carry that, but somebody has to keep the vision hot. And I would say even in the cases biblically that you said, Paul kept that vision hot. And so, yes, a team, yes, a body. I mean, Paul wrote that, right? Absolutely. But somebody has to keep that vision for that baby church. God has birthed a vision for a baby church. How do we bring that? Somebody's got to keep that going. Eventually, people have to share that. The team has to share that vision. But somebody has to define that.
And you were part of Lake Forest Family of Churches. Did they give you, like, just hundreds of people or anybody? Or did they say, good luck, goodbye?
You know, they gave me no people and no money. No, I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding. Truth be told. So I had 4 months to build a launch team. Best thing I did was the 10 weeks with the launch team. Happy to share more about that later if it's helpful. But I took 4 months and had a billion cups of coffee. I drank so much sweet tea, I gained 10 pounds. It was ridiculous because I didn't have sweet tea in LA.
Okay, sweet tea aside, tell me.
Yeah, okay. So I had Excel sheets with that I cold called over 400 people and said, will you meet with me? I want to share with you the vision for why we need a church for folks who've given up on church but not on God on the western side of Lake Norman. And out of that, about 42 people off that list, and then about 30 others that I did. I just met the guy coaching my kids' soccer team, the guy I worked out with at the gym. You know, people were hungry. Again, we've heard this. The harvest is plentiful. We're going to where Jesus is already at work. If this really is a vision God has for you, he's already got other people there. Priscilla's, right? I mean, right? They're there waiting for you to come with the vision God's birthed you, and there he's going to bring them to that vision.
Okay. So I heard going to the gym. Okay.
Yeah, my answer to this keeps evolving. When I landed in Phoenix, I came with like three brothers. I had three brothers, a friend EPC planner in Austin, Texas. He's the brewery guy, Christian Kreider, a friend of mine in the PCA. I needed two or three men besides my wife, which was crucial, who believed. Didn't believe in me, but they just believed. And they could keep reorienting me back to center. Beyond that, there was a guy that I connected with in YWAM, and he had done church planting and house church planting in Egypt and Lebanon. And he was describing his ministry to me. One day we were driving to Mexico, we're going to do a ministry down there. And he said, Rick, the thing you need to understand about the way we're doing ministry in India, for instance, he said, our leaders of the movement in 9 months hadn't come to faith yet. And that was just something that was blowing my categories. Like I said, people were going to lead with effectiveness and discipleship in 9 months who we didn't know, who hadn't come to faith. And that was our regular MO. And that just began to shift the way I thought about people here in the U.S. to say, I've had this mindset that says leadership and those who could run with me as a Timothy had to be those who had been in the faith for a long period of time, some long-term system, instead of the Lord granting me a faith that might be infectious. And seeing them rise to actually run with me. And if I was starting, I would still need those friends who would come and, like, through a phone call, believe with me. But I really believe that the Lord's prepared to do exceedingly abundantly more. And that we need to view people through these eyes of faith that say, okay, they don't believe yet. But they can believe in a way in a short amount of time that can make them infectious leaders in this neighborhood. So I think the Lord can, I mean, just out of everywhere around us, the Lord's prepared to raise up leadership. That's what he's doing globally right now, right?
Perfect. Okay. I think you, and then I'm going back to you guys. Okay. I know you've been, yeah, okay, here we go. One, two, three. Okay? Go.
Mine is easy. What's too old to be a church planner?
Wow. Okay. Real quick question.
I'm on the edge, it feels like. I mean,
how old are you?
55.
Yeah, that's on the edge.
I'm 49, so I don't know what the...
How old was Mark Hess?
He was like in his 70s, right?
I don't know about y'all, but if Rosemary goes and plants a church, I might follow her. She...
There you go. There is no age limit. Right to you, sir, because you're a desperate lover.
So one of the things that we heard yesterday, and the context was not church planting, it was probably missions, but to go alongside, come alongside where God is already at work. I'm assuming that applies to church planting. And so if it does, the question is, what did that look like in your church plants?
Okay. Short answers, I know, but if we want to squeeze that in, and we want to squeeze you in. And the rest of you, remember that paper I had you write down? Okay. If you want to add to that with your comments, like, I want to know the answer to this question, we'll get to it as well. But here we go.
So my quick answer, which I might change this in a few minutes, but would be, where is God at work? So number one, I know that God is committed globally to be at work. God was at work in me and my wife. Was he at work in the neighborhood when we got there? Probably. Did we see it? Did we know it? We didn't. It looked like everything other than God was at work in the place that we landed. So, but God had been at work in us, and we believed. And we believed he was with us and prepared to work. So that's how we entered, you know.
Yeah, I think we have to be very careful not to assume and get as arrogant to believe that we are actually bringing the gospel to a place. When we planted that church, we knew very well that the gospel had been there longer than both me and Nathan had even been alive. As a matter of fact, we're meeting in a church that's 100 years old. And so obviously we're going to a place where God has already been at work. And if you think that you are bringing the gospel, you might want to rethink church planting.
Okay, they're begging at the doors. Okay.
Short answer, God is at work wherever people are. And so let's go plant churches where people are.